Okay, we are recording. It is Wednesday, September 24th, 2008. I am Brady Banta, and I am in Blytheville, Arkansas, at the home of Mr. Jonathan Abbott, and we are conducting an interview on that will be part of the Bracero Oral History Project. Mr. Abbott, you are aware that I am recording this interview, and I have your permission to record the interview.
That's correct.
Thank you. To get this started, would you please just tell me a little bit about yourself personally and professionally so I can have some background information?
Okay, I'm Jonathan Abbott. I bill myself as the original local yokel in Blytheville, Arkansas. I am degreed. My degree is in economics, and I have one in general studies. My background is I have always been associated with farm families. My parents, my father being a longtime farmer here, he made his first crop in 1908, if not earlier. First crop he would claim he made in 1908. I am retired at this time. My wife has a business here in town. And we're sitting in my home, which has been my home for 65 years at least.
Okay.
And this house was built in 1930.
All right. You said that your father was a farmer and made his first crop here in Mississippi County, I presume,
that's correct.
In 1908. Where was the farm? Kind of give us a geographic location.
He homesteaded property in what we call Flat Lake, which was part of the Sunken Lands lawsuit controversy that took place some years earlier. And when they cleared that, and some of the title was turned back, some of the property was turned back to the federal government, he took advantage of that and homesteaded 120 acres, I believe it was, in what we call Flat Lake, which is now the interstate highway runs north of Blytheville. It runs north and south alongside Blytheville, and it would be in the north eastern section of the area of Blytheville. But the interstate highway basically run right down what we used to call Flat Lake Road, which was the way you got out of Blytheville to Flat Lake Road.
Okay, so would it be within the current city limits then of Blytheville, or just to the north of Blytheville?
No, it's just north and east of Blytheville.
Okay. Does it extend up to almost to the Missouri line then?
Not quite to the Missouri line, but very close to it.
Okay. You said that he homesteaded and started 120 acres. Did he continue to expand this operation?
Well, yes. The best way to understand my father was that he had a talent for making money. There are people that can sing. There's people can play the piano. He had a talent for making money. He expanded that 120. And I'm not sure if it was 120. It could have been 140. But anyway, it's in that area. He expanded that to by the early 60s, he was in the range of 8,000 to 9,000 acres of property that he owned. He didn't rent. He rented in his early days, but he started buying property way back. And he had farms. He had a large farm in the Boot Hill of Missouri in Duncan County, and then he had a large farm in Dyer County, Tennessee. And then he had a reasonably large farm here in Arkansas. Incidentally, 320 acres of it was in the east part of Blytheville and what we call Hamburger Row now.
Okay. All right. Is most of this land, other than what's here in Blytheville, still in cultivation?
Yes, all of it in cultivation, although none of the families is involved with it anymore.
Okay.
None of our family.
All right. What primarily did your father grow on this? Was it cotton or mixed crop?
Cotton, on the better land, and the rest of it was soybeans, corn, milo. He was one of his methods of making money, though, he would plant what we call corn and beans in the cutover land, or what we call new ground, and which he cleared most of the property. He had his own equipment, which he cleared, and he did custom clearing for other people. And he'd put it in corn and beans, and he every year, early in the year, or not early, but come the summertime, the way it used to be, the pastures would burn up in Mississippi, and he'd go to Memphis and buy at the slaughterhouse and buy the what they call cutters, which they was slaughter. They sold slaughter, but they would he would buy the better stock out of it. A lot of time it would be redshirt stock that would they had to get rid of it because of the pasture, and then he'd run them on his in the corn, beans, and things like that up until the spring, and when the price was good, he'd sell them. He did that for years and years.
All right. Did he get into the ownership and operation of cotton gins?
He had, at a very early 1920, he had a cotton gin here in Blytheville. The best way to tell you where it is, it was across the railroad track from where the post office is right now. It was Blytheville Cotton Gin. I don't know exactly how they had it, and he had a couple of his brothers work there at the gin, but he was a trader, and he traded around and got rid of it. That's all I can tell you about it.
All right. Did your father employ the Mexican migrant laborers?
Well, yes, but early on he did. And now this is, of course, I wasn't around when it happened. I'm just going from what I ascertained from him and the family through the years. Way back, possibly as late as the 1940s, but we're talking about 30s and 20s even. And because I know he used to tell a story about at the front door of this house, he had he would open up the front door of the house, and he had a table he set down in the doorway, and that's where he paid them.
All right. But he did not use, to the best of your knowledge, the bracero laborers in the 50s and 60s.
Not that I know of. There may have been a short period of time when they used on the operation. Others had apparently contracted, or others would bring them in, and he would. They used for chopping cotton sometimes. And one particular instance I know of was in the 1950s. He had a couple of busloads. I don't know how to explain other than that. On Island 21, he owned Island 20. My father owned Island 21, which is located out from Blytheville in the Mississippi River, and it's a big island. It's big, and they had a corn crop, a fresh corn crop planted there, and he had the laborers, he contracted through an operator of some sort. I don't know, but I know that they brought him over. And the reason I remember it so vivid is because it was fresh corn, good corn. It wasn't hard corn. Mm-hmm. It wasn't what you call feed corn. Sweet corn went to market. And they, my father asked the man that brought him out there, you know, did they bring anything to eat? And he said, no, Siddell, let's eat all this corn that they want. And Dad gave my dad a stomach ache to think about him eating all it. And it was hot. I mean, extremely hot for those guys to be out there eating it. But they ate that green corn. It wasn't green. But they ate that corn without cooking it. Unbelievable. And apparently they liked it.
Well, I mean, hearty constitution.
I guess so. But I know my dad got a stomach ache thinking about it.
I can imagine. were you living here in and around Blytheville during the 50s and early 60s when there was a large amount of the Mexican migrant labor being used in this area?
Yes, I was, and was aware of it.
Did you have occasion, either personally or professionally in your business operations, to be involved with them or to observe their activities?
Well, let me break it down a little differently. The most vivid recall I have of them is the colorfulness of it.
Okay.
They would come in, and they had, when I say they came in, the people that transported them in, brought them in. Not all of them were buses. Some of them had what we used to call bean trucks. They were 2-ton trucks, heavier trucks. Some of them were tandems, but most of them were single axle trucks. But the trucks would be multicolored. They would be painted by hand. Some of them, I'm sure, were professionally painted, but it was not unusual to be orange and blue and yellow or black or green, and it would be multicolors on the truck. So it's a very, very vivid memory from color, and almost to the vehicle. You could tell one of these transportation vehicles. I mean, it wasn't your father's Oldsmobile or Buick. It was always the very, very vivid colors, or sometimes muted colors, but unusual colors, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And the second most vivid memory I have is while they were here, and then when they started leaving, they bargained or bought, I don't know how they come about it, every portable foot operated sewing machine that was in this country. And you could tell when it was fixing to leave the country, because on top of the buses and other vehicles, now some of those bean trucks had hard tops on them. They weren't just all open. Mm-hmm. and they had hops on them, and they would strap those sewing machines upside down on the, and when I say upside down, I'm saying the top of the sewing machine would be against the vehicle, and the legs would stick up, and some of the vehicles look like porcupines when they leave here. There'd be so many legs sticking up in the air.
So these would be the old sewing machine that was in a sewing machine case.
The old Singer sewing
machines.
Yeah.
Okay. In conducting any number of other interviews, people would talk about the standard work week for these individuals would be 5.5 days, and they almost always had Sunday off, and almost always the employer would make arrangements or either personally bring them to town on Saturday afternoon to conduct, so they could conduct their business or wire their money home or whatever they were wanting to do. Do you have memories or observations of them coming to town like that?
Yes. Now, we were still in the 50s, 1950s. This was wasn't a totally rural town, but it was rural in nature. And it was the ending of the era when everybody come to town on Saturday night, and everybody knew where everybody else parked, and it was just kind of a social event. But this would be somewhat interrupted by the trucks and things that brought them into town. Now, my memory is located on the east part of Blytheville, Hayes Store, John Ide's Grocery, and Mr. Fault's Grocery, and stores like that, which were on the east end of Blytheville. And if you went in there, that would be crowded with the laborers. I remember a Hayes store. It seemed like it was Hayes store in particular. They even had some, for lack of a better word, interpreters in there. They had some people that catered to them that could speak, at least speak broken Spanish, or was not unusual. It seems like the churches even had a program set up for those. I don't know if it was a direct ministry or what they did, but they made their presence known. I mean, you could see them. They was there. And, of course, they dressed somewhat differently than we did. They all didn't look like the Cisco Kid, if you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that you could tell by their dress who they were.
Did you ever see or notice any particular tension between or among the Mexican laborers and the, I guess maybe the indigenous labor pools here, either white or black?
Well, at that time, now East End had its share of the African American public, but there was most of the African American people were, I don't want to use the word Carter, but particularly were on what we call Ash Street, and they did more of their shopping and socializing in that area as opposed to the whole town. Now, it wasn't strictly segregated. That's not the point, because especially like with Hayes' store. But, of course, Hayes was a big general store is what it was. And you could buy clothing and food. You could buy anything, shoes. He also had an implement place where you could buy Case tractors and stuff. It was an extensive operation for the times. The only thing that I know of, and I don't want to be off color or anything like that, I know that some friends of mine and myself had a good friend that was an older gentleman that worked for the county. He was one of the deputies, and he came and got us one night. We were sitting around trying to find something to get into, as young men would do in those age. And we got in the car with him, and we went out to where we called the Mexican barracks, quote unquote, at Stallings Farms. And we drove up there and had the lights off, and we observed there was a group of blacks there, and they were gambling with them. And then there was another car where there was some. Being very kind, I'd say black prostitutes, and that was going on there, and that was all very short distance from what we call the Mexican barracks, where the actual buildings where they stayed in.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only kind of interaction that I've ever seen like that. Of course, they turned on their lights and arrested the gamblers and what have you. As far as the general, you know. It seems like that I can remember where there was some scuffles and stuff like that, but nothing monstrous, you know what I'm saying?
Nothing out of the ordinary.
Nothing out of the ordinary. No police actions or anything like that, but just memories of run-ins now and then, you know, which probably could have been attributed to just a language barrier, to tell you the truth about it.
I interviewed Don Stallings this morning.
Right.
And he was telling me about the barracks.
Right.
Were there other operations that's similar to that had barracks facilities around here?
Yes. I wouldn't say they had them. I know there were some in this. I don't dare say the south end of the county, but more like the mid part of the county. That seems like that there was but I don't remember the actual buildings, if you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I was aware that there was other groups of them in the county, but I'm not sure exactly where it was and what kind of. But I just because the Mexican barracks are not far from here, and that's mm-hmm. why. That area, why I knew so much about it. And then, like I say, I know the Stallings is, and we were friends, and we would go out that way, and we could see them out there, and I knew they worked them. Now, I may be getting ahead of ourselves, but that was all. I always thought it was done through what they call the gin, Mr. Stallings' own mm-hmm. Red Top gin, and they contracted all, but they brought those in. But you could contract with the contractors, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what they did, is my understanding, it was just They just, you contact whoever had the labors and say, I'm going, you know, can I get 100 or 50 or 25 for 2 or 3 days chopping or picking or whatever it was. I don't remember them doing a lot in the picking area. They probably did, but I don't remember that as much as I do about the chopping, is when it, chopping cotton is what I'm referring to. But now they did other things too, other types of field work while they was here, clearing property and just general manual labor that they, but most of them was confined to the chopping and picking, as I understand it.
Would they come for the chopping season and do other work as available and then leave and then come back for the picking season, or were they here for the summer?
I want to say some and some.
Okay.
Now, I wasn't aware. Now, let me skip way ahead. In later years, even up until now, there has been some people that would come here and maybe 2 or 3 families that have 5, 6, 8, 10, maybe 12, 15, 20 of them would be together, and they still have some kind of an agreement. Now, whether, I don't know what kind of contracting, maybe they were freelance doing it on their own. Mm-hmm. But because I'm aware that there's several bunches, and that's the only way I know how to put it, would come back, stay with it on the same farm or in the same houses and things like that. But it seemed like even when it started tailing off or slowing down, that there would be groups of them come back here, maybe private, in other words, not under contract, but they would come in a truck, and it wouldn't be as many of them as it was. But that seemed like the way it was, especially I know that's the way it was with the, quote, the Mexican barracks, end quote.
Okay. Do you have any sense of whether the employers here locally preferred to use Mexican labor or local labor if they could get it?
Well, it was a transitional stage when all this was going on. Mechanization was coming on. It's what I've observed. And it seemed like that from what I understand from different people, that the local farmers were happy to get them. As I remember, the wages was always pretty well the same as if they was local people. In other words, you might see a field and it would have local laborers and the transported laborers in the same field. And I know that because it was not unusual that there was families of African Americans that stayed on farms year round, even at that day. Now that it was a wind up of it, mm-hmm. but people that had been with the farmer for years and years, and they would put them out there kind of as a lead. We always used to call them lead choppers and what have you. Yeah, they had lead people that if they stayed up with them. I know one instance, and it was dealing primarily with the African Americans that in the field right across the road over here, and there's some half mile roads there, my dad, the bus brought, these were blacks they were bringing it, and they unloaded on the bus, and they'd been out there about 30 minutes, and dad was talking with the man about what the pay was. And dad said, well, come on, I'll show you. And he walked out in the field, and there was 4 or 5 of them that was way out ahead of him. He said, these is $5 a day. And then he walked back in, and there was 4 or 5 more, and he said, these is $4 a day. And then the rest, there was a big knot of them that it's always slow about getting started. That's just human nature, I guess. But he'd say, you take all the rest of them home. I don't want them. and when they heard that, they all started chopping real fast, mm-hmm. going on, catching up with the first one. Mm-hmm. But that was the lead bunch I wouldn't think it would be unusual for many of the farms to have had lead people mixed in with the hired people. But I don't remember the only conversation I can meet in reference to that so-and-so has got the Mexican laborers, and they're a good bunch. And then you'd hear, so-and-so got a, and they're a sorry bunch. Now, that was the way the locals would refer to it.
Okay.
They didn't pick out individuals. They'd say, that bunch not worth a damn. And then, and I know in later years when they came back in small groups, they'd say they were really good. They get out there and you don't have to stay with them and all that, if you know what I'm saying.
Especially when the true Bracero program was functioning, and it was, I guess, for want of a better word, governed by an international agreement between the Mexican government and the American government. There were provisions for all kinds of inspections of the type of work that was being done, the living quarters, and all of this. Do you have any memories of local employers here talking about run-ins or encounters that they had with the inspectors, either from the United States Department of Labor or Agriculture or the Mexican consulate in Memphis?
No, not specifically. I do know that, and again, it's based purely on the Mexican barracks, what I knew about the Mexican mm-hmm. barracks. I do know that they were cleaner than you would think. And I'm talking about the people. I'm talking about the barracks himself. And I know when the weather was hot, and I guess this deals with the picking aspect of it, that the laborers themselves would sleep out in the fields in their cotton sacks as being cooped up in the buildings, which I guess, you know, it was cooler out there if you think about it. But they'd lay right out in the field. They'd just open. Of course, the cotton sacks were 8, 9, 10, 12, 14 foot long, whatever. And they just roll them out and crawl up in this, which was a lot of people that did that, not only. But they would sleep in the fields. But I do remember, because I had another friend whose father was did a lot of the overseeing about the Mexican barracks themselves, that they would go down there from time to time to work on the barracks and ensure that they were, I guess, livable.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it was inferred, but it was never spoken that they were having inspections or anything like that. But I was aware that they had certain standards that they had to adhere to.
Were you ever in the Mexican barracks?
Oh, yes, several times. But never only once or twice, maybe when there was actually some people there.
Yeah.
But no, afterwards, because they didn't really keep them locked up or anything like that. They were pretty open as far as...
I know from the interview with Don Stallings that if I remember correctly, there were three of these buildings that would house approximately 100 people
each. That sounds about right.
And it truly was just a barracks building.
That's exactly right.
But how would that barracks building compare with the accommodations of a sharecropper's house at roughly the same time?
Well,
or are we talking apples and oranges too much here?
Kind of apples and oranges. And neither place was a Holiday Inn.
Okay.
You have to understand that, because the standard of living was low here for basically everybody except for the very top. But the barracks themselves were absolutely Spartan. They had... I remember they had... fixed sleeping arrangements. They had built up in a two-story, and then some of them had actual cots, as we would call them. But there was not a lot. It seemed like they was even almost graded out, like there was Some of them were overseers and some of them. But I do know that they had a kitchen area. And I don't remember much about it, but I just know it was a designated area other than right where the bunks was. They had a kitchen area that was if my father would say where they batched, you know, it was that type of deal. And there was windows along the side for ventilation, tin roof, basically. It
get a little warm in
it. It was hot. Yeah. That's why I said some of them slept in the field. The only thing you can compare it to would be the very rudimentary, like army barracks. Just a long building with open draft in it and beds. And when I say beds, I don't even know if they had mattresses. I don't remember whether they had mattresses or not. But I do remember some of those built-in sleeping areas made out of 2x4s, and they had some form of fence wire made the bottom of the beds. Now, whatever they had padding, what to go on top of that, I don't know.
Some kind of pallet they might put on top.
Yeah, some pallet. Okay. And that was always my impression, that they all had little pallets that they rolled out and rolled up. And that was my impression. I'm not. Mm-hmm. But it was not. It was very Spartan, to say the least. They had water, of course, and it was running water. It wasn't pump water. It was now whether they was had a pump hooked to a something like that, or if it was city water, they could have had where the Mexican marriage was, could have had what we call city water, or hooked to this Blava water system.
Okay.
In privies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, privies.
But that was not uncommon of town. No.
No, no. That was that was not unusual.
Okay. In your sense, from your memories, when did the use of the Mexican laborers in this area stop being the norm?
Well, in the early 60s.
Okay.
That's just, I went off to, like everybody else did in 1964, to the Vietnam era. And when I came back, there was none. And I came back in 67. But it seemed like there was, but it was dwindling down in the early 60s. It is, the heyday of it was, what, 57, 58, somewhere in there. It peaked pretty rapid, and then it kind of went out pretty. But like I say, it was during the mechanization era, and that's when things were beginning to, it before farm chemicals got real big, is in that kind of a step we was making over to fully mechanized operation.
Okay. Did you had mentioned it at the beginning of our interview that your father used some Mexican labor in the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
Did any of those people stay around?
Well, kind of an offset. Right out here on what we call Airport Road, going to where John Ed Reginald's house is, in the corner of his drive there, or his yard, and there is a Mexican cemetery there, and I know there's 3 or 4 people buried there, because they had stones there at one time, and I was always told that was where Mexicans had died, and they buried them there, and so they must have been somewhat established to have stones put up.
Sounds like it.
You know, and if I'm not badly mistaken, I don't even know if the stones are still out there or not, but they were in Spanish.
Okay.
They had Spanish names on them anyway, or what I perceive to be Spanish names. But as far as any, like I say, the closest thing to staying, there may have been some arrangements where there was made with the individual families where they may have stayed over. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't rule that completely out, because it seemed like that during the time period you're talking about, there was some here basically all the time.
Okay.
And because I know through the churches that they had outreach programs. I said that before, mm-hmm. but that's the basic memory I have, that there was ministers going out for, and it seemed like there was outreach as far as clothing and things like that. And later years, there was a number of, Lord, for lack of a better word, indigent type outreaches for people that had, for clothing and things like that. That's just a part of my mind that we were always very involved with the church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I can remember that and them talking about it. And it seemed like a horrible way of explaining it would be the hangar owners, in other words, the ones that stayed around. It mm-hmm. seemed like that was more aimed towards those people than it was the folks that came in and did the labor and left.
Okay. It's my understanding, and I don't know exactly when this started, but the two may have overlapped, that at some period, I don't know if it was the 40s, 50s, 60s, there was a canning operation. If it wasn't in Blytheville, it was very close to it. Were the Mexican laborers involved in any way with that, either in picking the crop or working in the factory?
Well, I have seen, like everything else, that became mechanized.
Mm-hmm.
The type of things we would grow here for was particular for mechanization, greens, beans, and Bush Canning Company was involved here with most everything as far as that. But now Bush had a presence here for many years. The labor was seasonal. It would not be outside of the realm that they used some, even in their seasonal operations. But I have no personal knowledge of that. But that sounds correct, if you
okay.
know what I'm saying.
All right. Do you have any other, I guess, memories or vivid occurrences that we haven't touched on that you could add to our interview about the Mexican farm laborers here?
No, that's pretty well. Just as a kind of a side note, some of them had very particular shoes that they wore. They made them out of car tires. There was always people laughing about it, said they were running. You could hear their tires squealing when they run. But they took those the treads off the car tires, and they made the soles of their shoes out of those car tires. And then they had, I don't know if they rope or whatever, I don't remember how it was secured to. But I know for a long time, you could see in different places, you could see where somebody had cut out a sole out of it, where the tread of the tire would still be on.
This would be the type of shoe or sandal they'd wear in the field.
Yeah, a lot of them. Now, not all of them, but I'm mm-hmm. saying that was just something particular, outstanding, and I remember that, that was, and you'd see them wearing them around in town and stuff like that. I always thought it was pretty neat, you know, that they made it was a sandal-like shoe. It wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It was a sandal-like shoe, and it didn't generally have sides on it. But it was interesting. You know, that was an interesting aspect of it. And they've dressed pretty much like what laborers would dress like. It was not, they didn't have flamboyant dresses or anything like that. Some of them had the big hats that you would expect for the movies would portray them in, and mm-hmm. most of them did not, though. Most of them, many of them were just bareheaded. The women and kids looked about like what you would think they would look for laborers, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in later years, you didn't see as many big trucks, big transportation modes, as you did more pickup trucks with I don't want to say campers on them, but that's what they were. They were camper style. Most of them were homemade, had homemade type beds on them. And you'd see a sewing machine on top of them, too, every now and then. But it's funny how you do certain things you remember, but you did, I just remember those sewing machines real vividly. Mm-hmm. And pawn shops and what have you had those things for sale, and I don't know what the price of them was, but they... I've always wondered what happened to all those that they left here with, and if they did it everywhere or just here.
I don't know, but I've heard that's something that we, at least in the interviews I've conducted, mm-hmm. that's something that is frequently mentioned.
Yeah, but it's so vivid, you know.
Yeah.
When you saw it, it was it stuck with you.
And I have an idea also. It's probably a function of the fact that since Singer had that cabinet works mm-hmm. here close, that mm-hmm. there were a lot of those products ended up in people's homes here and then yes. ended up in the pawn shops or the used furniture right. store or whatever. Right. So they right. were probably a pretty good supply of them.
Yeah, that, it must have been. I don't know exactly why. I'm like you. But as they became obsolete after the electrified mm-hmm. machines came in. And incidentally, I have my grandmother's sewing machine that her husband bought her as a wedding gift. They went to St. Louis from Barfield Landing. They went up the river on a steamer. Mm-hmm. And he bought her. He was a real nice guy. He bought her something to work with while he was on there. bought her, and I've still got it.
Okay, I'm going.